evening, one and all. Yes, a Tuesday. I know, nearly September. Kids are back to school. Well, almost. Some are, some aren't, but they're getting there. And this is me, Barry, with another book and a chat. Well, here in Connecticut, where I am, it's not too bad. It's, the humidity's dropped a bit. It's like 75, 80. Just nice, you know, without the humidity part. But, I was thinking sort of like the weather and that, how it's changed. And I was thinking about how things change in life. Looking back, I don't know, 30, 40 years, whenever, half the stuff that we now pigeonhole or diagnose people with, we never heard of. We never heard of nut allergies or, you know, you couldn't drink the milk and you know, all that sort of stuff. And people who now can be diagnosed with something, you know, with them, before it was just, well, they're a bit slow or a bit simple or something like that. Now, yes, it can help, you know, lactose intolerant, that's what I was trying to think of before. It can help this, but you still doesn't help the families who have to grow up in this sort of, these environments in the past. And, you know, now you can look back and say, well, I could have done this, could have done that. But it doesn't help the people at the time, nor does it help perhaps looking back and, you know, memories and that. Well, my guest today, well, what can I tell you about him? He's a professional musician, journalist, playwright, writing instructor, and he's actually was shortlisted for the William Eisner Award in 2006 for a biography of comic book artist Wally Wood, which I think he did with David Spurlock, I think he did it. But the comic book part is still around, but this time the biography is a little bit more personal, and we'll find out about that, because on my show today, I am so pleased to say I have the one and only Steve Starger. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Hi, Barry.
How's things?
I'm glad to be here.
Well,
things are great.
It's
things
good.
Are very good.
That's good. I've talking before the show. You know, it's, we're just sort of saying, well, you've just moved from place to place with a mobile phone now, and you move from your home to visit sort of family and stuff like that. You don't realize, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, unless you had one of those great big clunky mobile phones. Yeah, this was never heard.
I remember them well.
Where have all the phone boxes gone? That's what I want to know. The days of the phone box.
Payphone.
Yeah.
Try to find a payphone. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh dear. So, as I said, you've done a biography before, and you were shortlisted for the award there, and that was a comic book artist, wasn't it, Wally Wood?
Yes, Wally Wood was probably most. Audiences, fans, excuse me, people would know his work from Mad Magazine.
Right, remember that, growing up, definitely, yep.
Yes, he was in every issue except four for the first 12 years, and it started out as a 10-cent comic book.
Yeah.
And Wally Wood was already a star at the publisher of Mad, which was EC Comics, Entertaining Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And they just segued to this Wild Humor magazine, after having drawn for such immortal titles as Tales from the Crypt,
mm-hmm.
you know, The Vault of Horror, Weird Science, things like that, some very heavy stuff for a kid my age back in the early 50s to be confronted with this incredible artwork. And so I had an occasion to get an entree to Wally's brother. And we did this book back in 1996, I started, and it came out in 2006. And,
wow.
It was quite a project, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the art in there, it was really good, some of the art. I mean, you know, there are simple ones like, was it Spy v Spy, which is just basically triangles.
Oh, sure.
but some of it.
That was the second generation of artists.
Right. Yeah, because it was really good. The early stuff, as you say, was especially.
Oh, yeah. It was phenomenal.
And it
Some
was
of
funny.
The satire.
Yes, the satire.
It was
extremely
funny. It was laugh out loud funny, yes.
Yeah, to me, it reminded me, I always remember when I, you know, in the 50s when I was younger myself, going to the dentist and reading the Punch magazines. And,
oh, sure. I remember Punch.
Yeah.
Yes.
And to me, it was like a children's version of Punch, in a way.
There you go. but it really had an adult twist underneath.
I mean, it was
serious lampoon, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. It was just a great idea.
I mean, obviously it's something you care about and stuff like that. Do you enjoy doing a biography type stuff, or is it just that's what you were led to?
Well, I consider myself, I write.
Right.
And I've written in many different genres. I never thought I'd be writing a biography of anybody. That was not, you know, way back in the day when I was itching to be a writer, I, like every other writer, wanted the great American novel under my belt, you know, but there were realistic things that came along as well, like newspapers, you know, journalism. I became a culture critic after a while, various jobs like that. I've written some plays. So I had the chance with Wally Wood's brother. I immediately, when I met him and found out he was Wally Wood's brother, I immediately suggested a biography, because most of his colleagues had already had biographies written about them. I said, Wally was one of the best of them all, and what do you think? Do you want to go with me on this? And it only took him a few hours to say yes. So off we went. And I started interviewing him, and he led me to other people, and lo and behold, I'm doing a biography, you know, and I used my journalism training to get through it. And I think we did a pretty good job after all, you know.
Well, you're doing a now in your new book, Misfits and Supermen.
Yes.
It's a biography, but it's more personal.
Very much so. I would look at it, if you want to use genre terms, I call it a memoir.
Right.
You know, it's an autobiography, but extremely subjective from the inside. And it's my life. It's my brother's life. It's a rather complicated tale, and I could not tell it all in one book, and I will probably do a follow-up at some point. But I had been for years thinking about kind of, I guess, memorializing my brother in print, because, you know, he was institutionalized probably from the age of 18 on in one place or another. And, you know, people like my brother have a tendency to slip into the cracks of society. Nobody remembers them really. Once I got mature enough to realize this, I didn't want that to happen here. So I said, I need to write something. So I started this book after many years of thought and many wild life turns of mine, and said, all right, here I go. And, here it is.
You know? And Melvin was your older brother. And as you said, I mean, he had this, a mix of disorders, I'd have thought.
Yes. Any one of them would have been enough to just knock a person out for life. He had three or four, maybe, major psychiatric disorders. The only official name to anything I heard, and it was probably in high school, was that he had, he had spells of catatonia, where he would just stand there, and if you pushed him in a certain direction, he would go in that direction until something in his way stopped him. So that's the only word I ever heard. Autism was not a word that was being used when I was a kid in the
50s. That's what I was saying at the beginning,
Exactly. You know, so it was a total puzzlement. I mean, I think there was probably some retardation there, which was the original diagnosis that he got. He was diagnosed as mildly retarded, and that's a diagnosis in the manual. Mildly retarded, and it has certain parameters that have to be reached. And I was in my 20s when I heard that, and I said, this isn't possible. That is ludicrous.
Yeah.
There's much more going on here. Until I looked up the definition, finally, and I looked at the criteria, and he fit at least three of the four major criteria. But the diagnosticians termed it mildly retarded. His conditions were way more serious than that label implies. That's as it turned out. You know, it was a devastating experience for my family. And I tried most of my life to get out from under it and just run away from it. I spent a lot of my growing up doing that.
And see, that's the thing, and that's the hard thing. Well, obviously, in those days, people just didn't know what the treatment was, didn't know how to help, etc. But you as a younger brother, you were under this, you know, what was going on, and it must have had its own sort of emotional and psychological effect on you.
Well, it did. I mean, my family was devastated. It was my parents and me and my brother. That was our little family unit. And they just couldn't handle it, you know. And I suppose you can't blame them, but I was a kid and not understanding. And my home, my house, consequently, was a place of tension 24 hours a day, basically. You were waiting for the next shoe to drop.
Right.
And that takes a lot out of a kid who's just trying to find his own identity.
Anyway. Right, yeah.
So, yeah, that was what I was dealing with. Yes.
And that's part of your book, isn't it? How it affected you and, you know, what it was like for yourself as well as your family.
Yes. It's a very large part of the book, actually. My first pass at it was to concentrate on my brother and be objective. Try to use my journalism training to stay objective and then talk about him. But a very good friend of mine who I showed her the first draft. I mean, I trust her instincts. She's a colleague of mine who helped. She directed some of my plays, and I trust her instincts. She immediately said, "No, you've got to put yourself in this story. It's you and your brother. You know, you are the character here as well." Oh. So I looked at it, and she was absolutely right. So I started a second draft totally in a different direction, including myself. And it turned out to be about our relationship.
Right.
Because he was able, I mean, he knew the people he was with. He was extremely withdrawn and in his own world, but at the same time, he knew who was there with him at the time, which is remarkable, but there it was, you know, and I'm glad I took that route, as it happens, because it was cathartic for me as well.
Right, because that's the thing I was going to ask, because a lot of people, when they write something like this, when they write about an illness or a sexual abuse or something like that, they find as they write, it's almost like a healing for themselves. It opens up doors that they shut and memories that they've hidden away and stuff. Did you find this?
I really did. And, you know, it sounds like a cliche and all of that and kind of new agey, but it's true. It happened to me. I mean, it took me 5 years to write the book. I don't know. The more I got deeper into it and trying to figure out what to keep in and what not to keep in, I found myself realizing really how I thought about this. And a lot of my choices in life, a lot of my travelings, my wanderings to get away, I was trying to get out from under this and go as far away as I could. And somehow I always ended up back in the fold. I wasn't the type of person who could abandon his family. And I suppose that's a good thing. And finally, when I, beyond coming of age, when I was in my 40s and everything else, it started to fall together more for me, obviously. And I said, yes, I never considered, you know, how deeply entangled I was when I was younger. But it came out. It really started to come out. And it showed me that our connection was really profound, as a matter of fact.
Did you sort of hit any, like, really black moments where you just couldn't write anymore? You know, you had to sort of just pull yourself away for a while?
I hear what you're saying. And, you know, I think writers go through that no matter what they're working on. But this really is close to the bone for me.
Right.
And, I did. I absolutely did. I was... For a lot of research, I was looking at old family photographs again. I have a whole boxes full that I'd seen over growing up over the years, and I studied them this time. I was really looking at expressions, the way people's moods might have been in the photo at different periods of people's lives, And I realized, wow, all the clues were there, with photos of my brother, photos of me, photos of my mother, and the way they looked. And so, yes, that opened up some pretty dark chambers for me. Yeah. And, you know, yeah. I mean, I'm far enough away from it, so I wasn't devastated by it. But I certainly, at this late age for me, had to take a second look at everything I had said and lived through. So it was pretty strong hit, yes.
Did you find, I mean, was it sort of like the family sort of basically living on tenterhooks? You know, did your brother have, you know, explosive episodes, or was it just, you know, what was going to happen next? There were. Yeah.
Gotcha. There were very explosive episodes. My brother did have a temper, and my father did too. And there were times when we would just, you know, there's one episode in the book I talk about a typical breakfast at our house when I was about, I was maybe 9 years old, so my brother was 18, you know, and we're just sitting there having breakfast. My mother's cooking, a typical scene, and my brother started flapping his arms because he was excited and happy about something. That's a symptom of autism in certain mm-hmm. people. Self-stimulation, it's called, stimming. Mm-hmm. And he started slapping his arm, which was a habit for him, and he knocked over a glass of juice on the table, on my father's morning newspaper, all over was running down on the floor. And then he started chanting, you know, he thought it was funny, you know, and nobody else thought it was funny. And then he did it again with a glass of milk. So now you have two glasses of liquid, red and white, running down the kitchen table, and he starts chanting first the milk, then the juice. And it became a chant, and my father started laughing, and everybody get into it. My mother, meanwhile, is falling apart because it's going to be on her to clean everything up and start all over again. Mm-hmm. It was just a bizarre moment that I have never forgotten, basically. Mm-hmm. So that pretty much describes what could have been a typical morning or a day in my household. You know, it was never far away from disaster. There was always something waiting. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Yes. You never know. Yeah. You literally tender hooks all the time waiting. Yeah. I mean, Misfits and Supermen, two brothers' journey along the spectrum. Now, obviously it was something you wanted to do in honor of your brother, something you wanted to do in your own mind to try and understand things a bit more, but also I'd have thought it would be there to help other people, who are to show they're not alone, perhaps.
Well, along the way, I did think of that, and I was thinking, yes, there are people who are going through this, and you know, different permutations of this. That if they read my book, and it gives them some solace, that would be just an extra.
Yeah.
A wonderful extra. And I would hope for that. That would be incredible for me. I mean, I've seen while I was out doing some readings over the past 6-7 months and doing other things, my audiences have mainly been, I have to tell you, either psychology professionals or people, as they say, on the spectrum, people who are actually living this. I had one incredible reading at my local library, and a young woman and her mother came, and the young woman was on the spectrum, and they bought my book, and they were so grateful that somebody had actually told this kind of a story, because this is what they live through every day. And I said, well, this is worth it. This was worth all the pain and the hustle of getting this thing together. So, yes, I would love it if somebody read this and took some kind of solace from it.
Yeah,
that would be incredible.
And that's, as you say, I mean, that what makes it all worthwhile. If some, you know, if it makes a difference to one person, or somebody contacts you and say how they enjoyed reading it, or you know, you understanding the situation that I'm going through. No, I didn't realize anybody understood it. That makes it all worthwhile, definitely.
It does. It totally does. I'll see how far it travels. You know.
Indeed. I noticed that part of the proceeds are actually going to a special camp in Quaker Hill.
In Connecticut, yes. Yeah. Down by in Waterford.
Right.
It's a Quaker Hills, you know, you probably know the section of Waterford down by the water. And yeah. My brother was there when he was, I was maybe 12, so he was like 20 years old. He was there for 2 years. I think it was 1953 to 55. And at the time, it was called Camp Waterford. And it was for residents like my brother and all ages. They had a working farm. It was an actual camp with bunks and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I just remember visiting with my parents when he was there. And he was pretty happy being there. And I'm looking at the photos from the camp, which thankfully I still have. And he looks really happy in them, which he didn't really look that happy in other photos.
Right.
I have to believe that that was probably the two happiest years he might have spent. And so a few years ago, while I was doing research for the book, I went back to the camp. And it was now called Waterford Country School, and then it had expanded into all kinds of services. It's an amazing place. They do such wonderful work. And, you know, I spoke to the executive director. I spoke to a leadership meeting about my project. They sent me my brother's intake papers, which they still had.
Wow.
Incredible primary source for me because I'd never seen them. I'm amazed they had them, but they sent them along. So that really helped me get a handle on all of that. And they were wonderful with me. So I do have this feeling that I owe them something for that. So yes, part of the proceeds, I started a scholarship in my brother's name for summer residencies for the kids, you know, from a 2 week residency in the summer. And I've been contributing to it every year. And I'm hoping, you know, I get proceeds enough that I can add to it from the book. That would be a great payback.
Interesting you saying about it being a farm, because I remember, doing the pony riding for, when I was in my teens,
okay.
For children there, you know, with special needs or whatever. And they produce this huge affinity with the horses, that when they were on the horses, they were not disabled or anything anymore. They were there with the horse as one. Did you find this with your brother with animals?
Absolutely. And it's interesting you mention that, because one of the staffers there, when we were down last a couple of years ago, the farm, the animals, a lot of them had been abused as well.
Mm.
In other situations, so they were shipped to the camp, and then the residents cared for them. So one of the staffers said, yes, it's wounded animals being cared for by wounded people.
Indeed,
and
so,
I thought
very
that
true.
Was just remarkable.
Very, very
that was
true.
So on the money.
Yeah.
You know, so yes, that has to be an incredible experience for them.
Must
you
be.
Know?
You said earlier on that, you know, this is the first one, and you could well be another one coming, you know, because you haven't scratched this. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think if I have time left in my life, that I would probably write another book of some sort. I don't know if it would be a Misfits Part 2 necessarily, but it could be around some of the same themes, actually.
Right.
It's possible. You know, there's ground, as I said, that I haven't covered in this book.
Right,
and
I'm sure there is.
I have to think about that, but we'll see.
I'm sure there will be. Well, time is going, so what I'm going to do now, Steve, is to hand the show over to you so that you can tell everybody how people can find more about you and your book. Over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this. So, Misfits and Supermen, Two Brothers' Journey Along the Spectrum is the full title of the book. It's available at all your favorite booksellers. You can order it or just get it online, Amazon, of course, Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, and anyone that you go to, or your brick-and-mortar store, if you have one, you can order it through them. It's all there. Or you can go to our website for the book, which is Misfits and Supermen.com. Misfits and Supermen is all one word. And there's a lot of information there, more about me personally and ways to get the book and things like that. It's published by Friesen Press, F-R-I-E-S-E-N Press, and they have a bookstore as well online, so you can go to friesenpress.com and find it there. It's readily available across the board.
Well, Steve, thank you so much, and thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it immensely.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It was wonderful.
Thank you. Well, there you
You're
go.
You're welcome.
My guest today, Steve Starger. That's S-T-A-R-G-E-R. S-T-A-R-G-E-R. And we've been talking about his autobiography, memoir, whatever you want to call it, Misfits and Supermen. A very interesting book that I think a lot of people this day and age can look back on and with interest about what used to be and how people, basically before people were diagnosed and help was there, be it cultural or mental health or whatever. As you said, he's got his own website, misfitsandsupermen.com. All one word. And you can find all sorts of stuff about Steve and about the book and everything. And of course, I'm sure it's got the link there for the Waterford Country School, .org, that is, being a school, waterfordcountryschool.org, which is, as I said, part of the proceeds go to that to help sponsor a couple of people, people to visit there for a couple of weeks in the summer. Very interesting chat, very interesting book. Well, I'll be back tomorrow with a fresh guest, but until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...